Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week.
After 10 years of experiment, television, first shown to the public at the World's Fair, now takes its place as a new American art and industry.
I'm Mark Emanuel of KZGM in Kabul, Missouri. Today on Sprouts, we will discover some of the most unique organizations and the people who run them in Columbus, Ohio. We'll call it America Discovers Columbus. First, we visit a haven for vintage electronic buffs and couch potatoes everywhere, a nonprofit museum dedicated to preserving the history of early televisions.
Has to get flashed 144 times a second,
but the film can't pull out.
You might not follow what these two guys are discussing, but it has everything to do with television, historical television technology to be exact. They are among the 100-plus attendees at the annual Classic TV Collector Convention held at the Early Television Museum in the Columbus suburb of Hilliard, Ohio. Each year, this unique museum plays host to one of the most unique conventions in the country, where Classic TV collectors congregate to swap, buy, sell, and discuss their passion, old analog tube televisions. You may ask yourself, as I did, who would undertake the job of being curator of such a museum, and what would possess them to do so? I stopped by the museum and spent some time with its founder, Steve McVoy. My first question is, how did he become so enamored with classic TV sets?
Well, when I was a teenager, I worked in a TV repair shop after school, and this was in the 50s, and occasionally we'd get a set from the 40s in to work on, and I was always fascinated by them. Then I was in cable television technology for my whole business career, and in 1999 I sold my company, and I was looking for something that would be interesting to do, and so I decided I'd collect old TVs. At that time, I didn't know that television started. I thought it started in the 40s. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about the previous history. So I, as I usually do everything, I went overboard and very quickly accumulated a lot of sets. And my wife wasn't very happy because they don't, you know, they're interesting looking, but they're not exciting pieces of furniture. So I was relegated to the basement.
Steve opened the museum in 2001 and today has about 150 TV sets that range in age from 1928 to the early 1960s. Just when transistor technology began overtaking vacuum tubes inside the cabinets. By now, the allure of solid cherry and pine Art Deco cabinets caught my attention, classic TV sets which lined the walls of every room in the museum. Steve took me through and gave me a quick lesson in the history of the television set.
When did television sets really become mainstream? What year?
That was after the war. But let's start way before then.
Way before then.
Let's go in here.
What do we have here?
Well, these are mechanical TV sets. The first TV pictures were actually made in 1926.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and they didn't use a picture tube and a camera like we have today. Instead, they had a rotating metal disc that has a spiral of holes in it.
Okay.
One at the camera, one made up the camera, and then one made up the receiver. And the first pictures, as I said, were in 1926, and 1928, the first television programming started being broadcast. The very earliest broadcasts were done by radio stations after their regular programming hours. And so they would go to TV because it was experimental.
Really? Huh.
And they only had one channel, so what they would do is they would alternate between the sound and the picture. And the picture was so awful, the quality, that often what they would do is they'd say, now you're going to see a bird. Or now you're going to see a woman singing or a man playing a violin and then they would switch from the sound to the picture where they'd show that picture. RCA, who were the biggest names in radio, the guy who ran it, David Sarnoff, decided television is going to be the next big thing. And so he invested $50 million in the development of television. And back $50 million back then was billions of dollars.
The individual or the company, RCA?
The company, RCA,
okay.
Right.
Now, even though the British beat Americans to broadcast video full-time on the air in 1932, By the late 1930s, television broadcasting was ready to go mainstream with the help of Sarnoff and RCA.
Sarnoff decided in 1939 that it was time to introduce television. And so he did it at the World's Fair in New York in 1939. And this is their product line, RCA's product line. And the cheapest one, again, was the cheapest one was almost as expensive as a car. You know.
And that screen size is 5 inches?
That's 5 inches. And this is a 9-inch, and this is their top-of-the-line 12-inch set.
So we got 1939 and then a gap of about, what, 5-6 years
That's
before
right.
they started making TV sets again?
Then when the war came along, then all of the engineers and production facilities went toward the war effort. And so the development of TV stopped. But the development of electronics didn't, because there were things like radar and VHF communications for airplanes that made great strides during the war. And those are technologies that are very important to television.
So even with only 7,000 sets sold before the war, were there still TV stations on in America during the war?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, there were quite a number who stayed that broadcast through the war.
Really? Look at it. Okay. Well, classic TV's on the move here today.
Right, yeah. This is a dangerous play.
In 1948, there were 200,000 sets in the U.S., and by 1953, there were 13 million. By then, television was an everyday part of American life. And in 1954, RCA teamed up with a strategic partner to develop color TV.
And they decided now's the time to really push color. So they teamed up with Walt Disney, and there was a program called The Wonderful World of Disney, which was Sunday night, It was designed basically to sell color TV sets. All the advertising was all RCA, and they made a big push, and that put it over the hump. And by 1970, there were more color sets sold than black and white sets.
And if you were wondering about the history of the remote control, although wired remotes had been around for decades...
Wireless remotes started in the... in the 50s, the first wireless remotes were a flashlight.
A flashlight.
With a little photo cell.
Okay.
And you'd aim it one side to change the volume and the other side to change the channel. It was like a ray gun, looked like. And then the next kinds were ultrasonic, and they had little chimes inside them. And the problem with them, two problems. One is that they would drive dogs crazy because they could hear the high-pitched.
But the humans couldn't.
Humans couldn't. And the third problem is that there were other devices that emit the same sort of sounds that could change the channel.
Ever since 2002, the museum has hosted a convention for collectors to share their passion. The convention also serves as a fundraiser for the nonprofit organization. We've heard from Steve. Now, what about the convention goers? A few of the attendees had their own reasons for being into classic television sets, like John from Pasadena, California.
I'm interested in the commercial history as well as the social history of television and broadcasting in general. See, unfortunately, many stations have, for lack of a better term, trashed their history. They throw out equipment, they throw out the paper records of their business, and those are the stories not just of their businesses, but also our nation as a society.
Or Bruce from Santa Clarita, California, and Jennifer from Boca Raton.
I still work at television, and Jennifer used to. She used to be the customer service manager for a company that made television equipment that was used in the transfer of film. And I used to work at that same company, and now I work for Universal Studios out in Hollywood.
Oh, I've always been interested in antiques to begin with, and then I have an electronics background, so just that combination just draws me in. And this was something that he wanted to do. He had never, we're here together. And
I had always wanted to see a working field sequential TV that used the CBS color system, and there it is. It's working right over there. You can watch it.
Do you folks have collections of classic TVs at your own homes?
I have some older TVs, but nothing like this.
And one more thing. Steve tells me they're called TV sets, even though there's just one, because of the set of components inside early radios. The term carried over to televisions. In most museums, display items are for show only. Here, many sets, regardless of how old, are in working condition, and visitors are encouraged to flip a switch on the wall and gaze into the flickering screen of a time capsule. More information is online at earlytelevision.org. Next, in this episode of Sprouts, we go to a small business who holds the distinction of serving dozens of one-of-a-kind flavors of one of America's oldest snack foods, popcorn. When you think of popcorn, three flavors normally come to mind: butter, caramel, and cheese. It might surprise you, then, that there is a small company local to Columbus that does something few others can claim: make over 70 flavors of the classic snack. Interested in why someone would go through the process of creating so many varieties, Sharon Schrock, the owner of Owl's Delicious Popcorn, took me behind the scenes and literally gave me a taste of her business.
Al started the business when he was 70 years old. My husband and I bought the business 7 years ago. It's kind of a miracle to have a retail business in the same location thriving for 27 years.
So, since 1985, a suburban strip mall has been the home to Al's Delicious Popcorn, and just about the only thing that's changed over the years has been the menu. Upon first walking into the store, I was greeted with the sight of dozens of tubs of different colors of popcorn, each representing a different flavor. And, keeping with tradition, free samples are handed out by request to anyone that stops by. As I munched on some recommendations, Sharon took me through some of their flavoring process.
How do you come up with all these flavors?
Well, we're a very creative team. Some flavors are combinations, like you just tasted caramel apple, which is a combination of our caramel and our green apple flavors. And all we do is throw those two together. It's colorful because the apple's green and the caramel's brown. And out of two other flavors comes a third in a combination. And another one like that would be creamsicle, which is our number one vanilla butternut flavor mixed with orange. Other things that we do are experiment with flavors that people are beginning to become acquainted with or begin to like. Like, we have a mango popcorn, we have a pomegranate, we have a flavor called Buffalo Ranch, which tastes like a wing. We also make s'mores and a Rice Krispie treat.
Yeah, I see that. Does it really taste like Rice Krispie treat?
Sure, you want to taste it?
Yeah, let me have a little bit of that.
You would think that the public is more explorative to go beyond the basic flavors, but Sharon says the top four flavors are vanilla butternut, caramel, cheddar, and butter. Well, that's great, but how does she keep the flavors tasting authentic, and how is it made?
We will not make a flavor that says it's X flavor, but doesn't, to us at least, really taste like that flavor. Mm-hmm. It has to be, our root beer has to be root beer. As a matter of fact, we changed vendors on part of that, and we went back because the root beer just wasn't up to our standards. The two machines over here are the kettles that we cook the syrup in to make the candied popcorn.
How much? Those are several gallon tubs. I mean, those are huge.
Those are 15, 16 gallon coming out of there.
And you do it all at once. Take the bag of popcorn here, you just dump the whole thing in the kettle. Stirs it around?
Yes. Yes, we actually do.
So all
in
one batch.
And then you dump it out on those stainless steel tables to cool, and you have to make sure that it doesn't stick together. So you do what we call fluff. You fluff the popcorn. Okay.
So it doesn't seem to be all that labor intensive to make a huge batch, and there's a batch there that's, what about?
Well, actually, it's very labor intensive.
Really?
Because when you think that 15, 16 gallons is a lot of popcorn, that's basically a little more than our extra large bag.
What about the savory, salty flavors? Does she just sprinkle the flavor on?
Yes, you sprinkle it on, but you do it in these big bags and bins, and then you shake it.
So low tech.
Yeah, very low tech.
But it works.
But it works. We actually had a machine that did it, and we can do it better and faster without it. Isn't that a kick?
So people get to keep their jobs, essentially, because machinery just hasn't kept up with popcorn
absolutely
making technology.
Absolutely.
With so many flavors, Al's Delicious Popcorn allows customers to create their own blends. I had to ask, then, what was the strangest combination Sharon had ever seen?
We used to have a board in here that said, create your own combo. and people could choose up to three flavors, and one was pizza, and one was vanilla butternut. Yes, I know, you're giving me one of those, you know, wrinkly nose looks. And there was a third one, and I mixed it. I did not taste it. But pretty much, you know, after somebody makes some weird combination, that's the only time that they ever do it. Combinations that we make, we taste test, like mm-hmm. the caramel apple, which right. is like dynamite, or the Chicago mix or the Columbus mix. I have had people ask for more tropical flavors mm-hmm. and more Indian flavors, Middle East flavors, and we keep looking for what works.
And with that, business began to pick up, and I had to let Sharon get back to serving up all the flavors of the rainbow and then some. Before I left, she shared one final thought.
Our team here is called the Delicious Team, and we remember that. That's what we do. That's what our responsibilities are.
And how many people work here?
About 12.
12?
About a dozen.
Wow. Okay.
We have not everybody in every day, but we're open 6 days, so nobody usually works more than five.
Every day but Sunday?
Every day but Sunday.
Okay. Is there a website address folks
there
can go to?
There is.
Okay. What would that address be?
That is www.alspopcorn.com.
How come delicious isn't in your website address?
Because it's too long.
And people like me would misspell it all
That's
the time.
Right. That's right.
Well, Sharon, thank you very much for taking us around the shop here. This popcorn is delicious.
Well, you're very, very welcome. Come anytime.
And from this Columbus suburb, Al's Delicious Popcorn truly lives up to its name. You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Mark Emanuel of KZGM in Kabul, Missouri. And this week, America discovers Columbus, Ohio. The final segment today offers a look into a homegrown green business, which makes a variety of products from a variety of recyclables, some of which may surprise you. In an industrial part of southern Columbus, the story of one man who grew a business from his parents' basement into a means of saving the environment unfolds. Imagine, if you can, making a plaque from beer bottles, frames from old circuit boards, or hammocks from plastic bottle caps. Well, such a thing happens at Weisenbach Recycled Products on a daily basis. It's here the company that bears Dan Weisenbach's name shows us how we can all make an impact at saving energy and resources.
We started the business 31 years ago. Actually started with my parents. Primarily we were in the printing and promotional products and manufacturing. In 1989, that sort of traditional printing, we switched over all of what we did to soy-based inks and recycled paper, whether folks asked for it or not.
Were you ahead of the curve? I mean, was that?
I'm not sure there was a curve yet.
Did anybody know what recycled paper and soy-based
well,
ink
sure, and I think in the early days of recycled paper back in the 70s, which was actually before my time, there was some move toward that, but the quality wasn't there. So the recycled paper at the time had a bit of a bad reputation for printers and for copiers and for people in general. And in the mid-80s, 86, around there, we started selling recycled plastic products. We weren't making them ourselves at the time, but we found a couple of suppliers that would provide a recycled plastic item for us. They were all black, and because it was mixed colors, uh-huh. So they made them black. And we sold a handful of items, six or eight different items. And the way we promoted them is they were a penny less. To buy recycled would be one cent less. If they didn't mind that it would be black and be out of recycled, you know, it was like, well, yeah. So if they bought 500 items, they saved $5, which actually worked.
Of those early plastic bottles, Dan sold fly swatters, ice scrapers, and ironically, oil funnels that prevented leaks out of oil cans. One surprising aspect of Dan's career that he admitted to was that he didn't get a college degree, yet he still explained the reasons for his company's early success.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find too many entrepreneurs and folks that are running businesses today that do have a college degree.
Really?
And you know, while my friends were taking out huge loans to pay for college, I took out a moderate-sized loan and bought equipment.
Hmm.
And then I went to school on the money I made from manufacturing product from the first pieces of equipment that I purchased. That was in 1980, 1981. When I was doing that, we started the business at the end of 1981. So I was talking to a group of high school students and asked them if that's what they would like to have someday. And they certainly agreed that, you know, most of the class would love to do that. I said, would you be willing to work for 3 years where you're working 16 to 20 hours a day for 6 days a week at least and making maybe $40 to $60 a week? And nobody raised their hand, but that's how you start a business.
He started a tour of his facility, and I noticed a lack of aluminum products. Dan explained that aluminum recycling requires a large footprint, and that plastics and glass recycling could be done much more efficiently. He went on to stress that he now produces dozens of different post-consumer products because it was important to provide different products at a local level.
You don't have to be stuck with buying, you know, the standard things that everybody else does. Mm-hmm. I mean, look locally, buy things locally, support your local manufacturers. And I only say that around town here. When I'm in Austin, Texas, I like them to buy from us too. So support us no matter what. but I think more importantly, we could say when you're supporting local, for business to be successful and for any business to really be successful, you have to take care of your employees. You have to be responsible in your community. You have to take care of your environment because you work where you live.
For some reason, the wide use of penguins was more than noticeable throughout his building. And from that, he went into his company's slogan.
Penguins! And recycling is cool.
I did notice the big penguin poster on the wall there.
Yeah, and it's our company trademark and for logo as well. That people ask, why do you have a penguin? Well, I've always liked penguins, so that's a side point. But, you know, with our motto being recycling is cool, and penguins are cool, so why not?
Actually, penguins are cold.
No.
It's the ice thing.
They don't feel cold.
Dan then went on to point out a recycled pencil that brings new definition to green.
Then I see you have a big old thing of, these are recycled pencils.
Yeah, these are pencils made from recycled money.
What? This is U.S. currency.
That is U.S. currency.
You're kidding.
That's ground up to a powder, actually, and then compounded with a polystyrene or plastic, and then extruded with a graphite resin, and that's how the pencils are made.
Does the government sell you the money in raw form? And
they're glad to get rid of it. They just give money away. Actually, once it's shredded, it's not worth it.
Oh, okay, so you buy the money shredded.
I was on a committee to try to figure out ways to use that, and we actually were not successful. Some of the thoughts, because you can use newspaper, and Emily's looking at a newspaper pencil there, animal bedding. You can use newspaper for animal bedding, and then it's composted or whatever. So you could do that with money, too, but the farmers completely refused because U.S. currency was too dirty to put their cow on it.
Among the various machines located throughout Dan's facility was a large grinder, which takes the plastic caps and turns them into shards of reusable material that Dan uses to create many of his products. It's a simple process that takes 3 large scoops of caps at a time to fill 4-foot square bins. Of one bin, Dan can make nearly 13,000 oil funnels, and there were many bins waiting for production. They don't have the extrusion machines on site, that's done locally at a different business, but the printing and packaging takes place at Weisenbach Recycled Products. Dan moved on to the pencil and pen printer, being overseen by one of his employees. He stressed the importance of balance between buying a machine versus hiring a person.
And, you know, so many times as a manufacturer, I have to make a decision. Do I put in a piece of equipment or do I put in a person? And one of the things in the equation of running a business is what's the best thing to do? If you have a machine do it, a machine is going to have a certain cost to it, both in purchasing it and running it. In the long run, a machine is generally less expensive than a person. However, it has a limited capacity. So if a machine can do, you know, 1 per second, I can have as many people as necessary to get a job done. Mm-hmm. If I have a big job to do, and it's something that can be done by hand, I hire more people. You just don't have that kind of flexibility if you're limited to machines.
Okay.
So that's why we try to develop our people, and that's why they have so many skills, is because they get to do so many things by hand around here.
Hidden in the back of his storage area was a small piece of equipment that was, it turns out, Dan's first, predating his involvement with recycled paper. In true entrepreneurial style, he discussed how this one button press came to be.
My first loan from the bank to go to school back in the day was $1,500. And I was able to buy this machine and a cutting machine. I bought some table legs, like some metal table legs from the hardware store. And my architecture-like design project, I bought one 4x8 sheet of plywood, and I made the base for this machine, the top of the table, a back edge of the table, a bottom shelf, and the base for the cutter. And I designed them all so I could take them on and off of the table, with holes in the corners to mount them and everything. I did it all out of one sheet of plywood.
Wow.
It's all I could afford.
Beyond a laser etching machine was the art department, where Dan stressed the importance of creativity by his team. Part of the creative process, he said, was the need to work with other companies and nonprofits in the community.
Olin Plastics, they're much like us, they do a lot for the community.
Mm-hmm.
They're a big sponsor of the Ronald McDonald House,
okay.
Which Ronald McDonald House is a nationwide charity,
mm-hmm.
and they do a lot of work for them. And we're looking for more products that we can manufacture, and then we'll donate a portion of the project to the Ronald McDonald House.
Nice.
So we're able to support a lot of nonprofits out of what we can manufacture and produce here as well. So
nice.
We're glad to do that. And it's part of being in the community as well. So
okay.
Gives us something to do when we're not in the office is go volunteer somewhere.
Dan's passion for volunteering blended well with his passion for saving the environment. To him, being part of the community and helping people as much as the environment is what his business is all about. And something we can all learn from.
It makes sense. I don't know how else to explain it than recycling makes sense. It saves energy. It saves resources. It supports jobs. It's silly not to. And I think the more we catch on to that, and it's not a political thing. With its recycling and environment, if there's one thing we can agree on, I mean, hey, let's argue about how's the best way to recycle or how we can recover the most material. But whether to do it or not is not a discussion. We really need to do this, and it's good for all of us. So it's without question, a clean environment is the vital thing for all of us.
All right, Dan. Well, thank you very much for taking us around here.
My pleasure. That was fun.
It was.
More information about recycling and Dan Weisenbach's company is online at www.recyclingiscool.com. That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to America Discovers Columbus, Ohio. Our contributors this week included Steve McVoy from the Early Television Museum, Sharon Schrock from Al's Delicious Popcorn, and Dan Weisenbach from Weisenbach Recycled Products. Production assistance came from the Columbus Chamber of Commerce, with a special thanks to Pacifica affiliate WCRS in Columbus. The Sprouts music theme is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was me.
Bill Huntley, NBC News, New York.
And David Brinkley, NBC News, Washington.
And I'm Mark Emanuel from KZGM in Kabul, Missouri. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.